Hey, calling the meeting to order. Right on track.
Did you watch that video?
Okay, matters under the jurisdiction of the board and not under, on the posted agenda may be addressed by the general public before or during the regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not on the posted agenda unless it is determined by an emergency by the board of retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the public comment period shall be permitted to be heard once up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. Any person wishing to make a presentation must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all board members. Presentations will be limited to 3 minutes. Okay. Roll call.
Lynn Betancourt.
Here.
Marie DeAnda.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Mike Fisher.
Here.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Ron Martin.
Here.
Clarence Willman.
Here.
Linda Stotts Burnett.
Here.
All board members are here.
Okay. Full house. Announcements. We're seeing none. Any public comment? We're seeing none. Consent items.
Make a motion to approve the consent item.
Second the motion.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay. Abstain. Abstain.
Okay, so moved. Next takes us to EFI actuaries.
Okay.
You're on.
You should have a copy of a letter that we sent in response to questions sent to us via Tom. Thank you very much for the questions. There were a lot of good questions in there. I think we're somewhere over 30 of them. You have a copy of our response. I just want to highlight probably the response to the first question that just summarizes sort of where our recommendations are right now. Our recommendations are, for the most part, as we recommended in the experience study, with a couple exceptions. One, with respect to the investment return assumption, which previously we had recommended you lower to 7.9% based on a 3.5% inflation assumption. We got a copy of the final excess earnings policy from Tom, and when we did our modeling of what that excess earnings policy could mean in terms of future assets that may be designated as non-valuation assets in the future, we're now including that clawback provision that's in your policy, where if the funding ratio drops below 90%, any assets that are set aside into non-valuation assets could be brought back into the fund. And we also looked at what is the current amount of the contra account and started that as sort of a negative balance that you would have to get out of that hole before any excess earnings would ever be granted for non-valuation benefits. When we redid the modeling using those provisions, the impact of the excess earnings policy on the long-term rate of return was vastly reduced. Remember last time we were talking about 0.2%. When we did this analysis, we were looking at an impact on the long-term cost as a percentage of pay of like 2 basis points, which translates to next to nothing in terms of the expected rate of return. So really, the way that the policy is currently stated, if we were, we stochastically modeled where we buried the expected returns in future years and simulated them and saw what would come out of that in terms of amounts of excess earnings and non-valuation benefits, the impact was basically what we would consider to be de minimis over the next at least 20 years. So we've adjusted our recommendations with respect to the excess earnings policy. Also, I happened to be at a meeting last week or 2 weeks ago with Paul Hart, and he told me about the changes that you had made to the asset allocation policy. So we got the new asset allocation policy from Paul and redid our simulation analysis of that. That added a little bit to the expected rate of return, which I think he probably told you about, by adding, mezzanine debt class, and then the other one being
infrastructure.
So we redid our simulation analysis. That was also contained in this letter. you're looking at an expected rate of return if we use a 3.5% inflation assumption of somewhere around 8.3%. But we also laid out reasons why we think it's wise to use an expected rate of return less than that, and we said 8%. That gave us sort of the same cost basis if you're using the lower inflation number that sort of the markets and investment people are using. They're using something closer to like 2.5% to 2.75%, even over the long term, even over a period of 10 years or longer. When you measure the cost of the plan, if you were to use a lower expected rate of return, expected inflation assumption like that, it tends to increase the cost even if you're leaving the real rate of return, the return above inflation, the same. So this 8% return that we're recommending gives you the same conservatism as the, that 8.3%, the 4.8% real return, right? The 8.3 minus the 3.5. The same base, it's the same cost basis as if you're using that inflation assumption. So that's why we came up with that 8% return. Sorry, that's probably not a great explanation of it. But also, as we've mentioned before, we have found that the SIS expected returns by class are a little more optimistic than some of the other investment managers that we've worked with. So it's another reason why we thought that the 8% rate of return would be more reasonable than using the full 8.3%.
In your write-up on that section, I noticed the word immediate was not in there, where on all the others had an immediate. In other words, on the bullet points, you have a service merit pay immediate, vacation immediate, age immediate. On the one you were just discussing, there's no immediate. Is that an indication that on priority basis the others are higher priority?
No, I should have put that in there, that we would recommend that for the next valuation you adopt an 8% expected
so
rate of return.
So everything listed here is immediate.
Exactly, except for, and this is the other change, the funding methodology changes that we're suggesting. Remember, we've had some discussions about different variations of what we call the entry age normal method. The sort of standard methodology is to use what's called the individual entry age method, where you're adding up the normal costs for each individual. The methodology that Buck had been using was, in essence, an aggregation, where you would take the total present value of future normal costs and divide that by the present value of future salary for everybody to get the normal cost rate. They're both acceptable from the standpoint of you are going to collect enough assets over time if your assumptions are met to pay for the benefits. But the GASB preliminary views, which I think Bob might have discussed at the last meeting, has some indication that they may be requiring the use of that individual approach as opposed to the aggregate approach. But when we talked about this, these preliminary views aren't settled yet. They haven't come up with any sort of final recommendations or requirements, and it will take a few years before they actually put any new requirements into place. So we think if the board wants to consider deferring or delaying any change in the funding methodology, we think that's reasonable, considering that the methodology that you're using is still an acceptable actuarial funding method. And those are the two major changes from the experience study report. I'm happy to address any of the questions that were asked and our responses to them. Total cost. When we looked at, if you remember before, we were looking at a total cost impact of over 4% of pay. If you take out the change in the actuarial funding methodology and you look at the 8% expected rate of return, you're looking at an increase in the total cost of about, I believe, 1.6% of pay. Haven't exactly calculated the split between the employers and the employees, but based on the fact that I don't expect there to be a very large increase for the general employees' contribution rates, because we were recommending more conservative male mortality but less conservative female mortality, and again, the economic assumptions are actually slightly less conservative. So I'd expect maybe a slight increase in cost, maybe a few tenths of a percent of pay for the employee contribution rates. The safety contribution rate increase might be slightly higher because, again, we're recommending more conservative male mortality tables, and you have a much higher percentage of males in the safety population.
But in that case, the employees don't pay the rate anyways, so it doesn't matter.
I know. Our cost is just, we look at the employee pickup.
You're trying to figure it out.
So I think the safety increase in contributions might be slightly higher, somewhere around 0.5% of pay. That's just a rough guesstimate. And again, any increase that the employees are paying, that's less of an increase for the employer in terms of the total cost.
So the 4.29% becomes
1.6.
Let me ask you on your... I saw that many of these numbers are in here in terms of your calculation, but I'm not seeing a breakdown as to how it impacts the system on the individual sub-items. In particular, I'm looking at the county's present policy for allowing sale of vacation time at the end of the person's career. We were in this study the first time, taking that into account specifically. Mm-hmm. I mean, generally, a cost has been built into the system over time at different times because we've noticed the difference of shortfalls. But at this time, we're making a plan for the future. What is the? Can you tell me a ballpark of the increase in cost to the employee and to the employer for those? Benefits?
For the employee, it would depend on what tier you're in, because if you're in tier three, there's not going to be much impact. Sorry, not tier three. Any tier that has a 3-year final average pay, there's not going to be much of an impact.
Right.
For the total cost, in our original analysis, it was about 1.1% of pay. I think that it's probably, we didn't recalculate it with the new assumptions.
Right.
But I'm guessing it's slightly less than that because you're using a higher expected rate of return and we're not doing that aggregation
piece.
So maybe it's
1%.
Something less than 1.1% in terms of the total cost impact. And again, that's actually the largest... that was... 1.1 was incorrect. It was 0.7%. 1.1 was the service-based pay rate. So less than 0.7% in terms of the total cost. In terms of the employees, I would say a few basis points.
I have a serious concern on that point. If that could be broken out and we postponed action on that particular item, I think it would be appropriate. And the reason why is, unless we postpone action on our entire decisions on this, because I think the county should be given time to analyze that and figure out that amount. That's the driving force in the majority of the cost increase we're talking about here for the county. And they have total control over that. They don't have total control immediately. They have over time in negotiations. And they have total control over that for about half that cost, because about half that cost, as I understand, is management. I might be off on that, I don't know. The numbers I heard before, I understood that about half that cost was management cost. So they have total control over that. So they have total control of the negotiations there. If they took some time to reevaluate that policy in determining final compensation, they might choose to do something different, as they're right now negotiating to do something different for employees for their general benefits, to go from 1 year to 3 years, to go from current percentage values to other percentage values. And they've already done that to management. If we gave them a little time to do this and they came up with that decision to take that action, it would certainly impact our system. And we might be able to make this change if necessary at a later time if they chose not to. Postponing a decision like this is going to cost money if they maintain the benefit at that level. We don't know how long it might take for them to make that decision, but let's say we postpone this decision. How long do we have to make our decision?
The valuation report is for the valuation
the
as of July 1st, 2010.
Right.
It's currently underway. We anticipate, same as last year, probably something around January providing the preliminary results in the December, January timeframe. So we need assumptions in place in order to run those valuation results.
So by end of the year, you're looking at it necessary to make everything move, continue to move through smoothly.
Now, there's an issue that...
Graham was there.
I would much rather have December 1st in terms of being able to get stuff to the board a week in advance.
Right.
Okay. I mean, so that's depends on if the meeting is in December versus January versus February.
Yeah.
There's clearly
a
set of things.
Yeah.
One other issue is that we are looking at all kinds of, when we did our analysis, the methodology that we used was to collect the benefit calculations that had actually been done over the last 2 years, right? The actual final average pay compared with what our valuation pay was. There may be other things at play there other than just sick leave cash outs in terms of, you know, do people tend to get promoted close to the end of their careers or other things like that. We did not look at, you know, we looked at the total final average compensation compared to valuation pay. Again, we're confident that the sick leave is the, you know, the cash out is the majority of, sorry, the vacation cash out is the majority of that. But there's no guarantee that there aren't other items that might still contribute to some sort of terminal payload. So even though, you know, if there were a policy change that reduced that, at least for management, it might be tough with the current valuation to come up with a better assumption given, you know, the data that we have at this time.
I'm sorry, Lynn. Maybe I'm a little slow today. I'm not quite get. I understand that you want to be able to get the most up-to-date information as possible in terms so that we can get the best decision that we can make now. But I think as I read in here, and as I think Graham just said, I mean, we're dealing with a point in time, really. And how far do we wait? How far do we, you know, in the future when we're really dealing with an experience study, right? So, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, because there are some changes that take effect in January. I'll mention management because that does go into effect. And that's a done deal. And as to whether any other negotiated items for general labor and such, I'm not seeing why we should delay any action at this point. What any changes might change any of the decisions that we possibly could make today.
Let me be real candid then.
Please.
If the county were to choose to explain as a matter of policy and as a matter of practicality, they do not have the funds to pay these cash outs for the foreseeable future for at least X number of years, 3, 5, 10, whatever number of years that they can project out. I don't think 10 is reasonable. But if they were to say that, we would know that that's not going to happen. Okay? If we, on the other hand, choose to use the experience study that we have, which is real dollar information, not some projection, if we choose to use that methodology, and that's all that our actuaries have available, then we will be billing, basically taxing employees for a benefit they cannot receive. We will be saying to these employees, now we didn't say that the past employees that already retired, that the experience comes from, but we've got to say to the new employee, or the current employee, hey, you need to pony up extra money because you might do a vacation cash out. And that employee may well not be able to receive that benefit because no cash outs will be going to be available because of the economic problems of the county. If the county were to negotiate that as we're not going to be doing those cash outs at all, then it could be seen by our board, though it can't be seen by the actuary because he goes by experience only, that the experience has changed on a more permanent basis. If it's on a temporary basis of 3 years, that's something else. But if it's on a permanent basis, it's another thing. So I'm thinking, I don't know what the county's response to this is, or if there's going to be one. They've already had some response by negotiating change in benefits for management. They've announced that they're negotiating a change in benefits for general employees, all new general employees. Put it that way. But the cash out, they don't have any money to do right now. Now, they may say, well, I'm going to pay them later, or I'm going to pay them now. It doesn't really matter. It's a few dollars between, a few months between paying them off at the end of a fiscal year as opposed to at the end of their career. to allow these cash outs. I understand that. But they also need to understand what the impact is. If they want to spend the money, okay, but I haven't heard from the county if they want to spend the money. Mm-hmm. I hear them crying and screaming and hollering, we got to have your money, whatever you have in reserves. And I'm not hearing them say what their decision is on this issue. And they have a decision to make. They can choose to make it, not make it by not acting.
Actually, I had sets of information, and I'm sure many of you are aware of, a pending legislation, but we had so much stuff on the table, we were delaying it for next month. What's the bill?
It'd be 1987.
That one. And I think that may or may not have any impact on maybe what the county can or cannot do in the future, or employee organizations can or cannot do in the future. So, but I hear what you're saying. I got it.
That's my position. I mean,
yeah.
But that's what I'm trying to get. But I may be wrong. I'm just throwing it out.
No, I hear you.
But the experience study is based upon current data, current figures, and the current pool of employees. Whatever changes the county makes, and they've made a lot of changes, the bulk of the changes have been made. You still have others to make, but the bulk of them have been made. That's not going to change anything, the current pool of active employees, which is what we're talking about. So, I mean, Lynn, I understand what you're saying into the future, and that could be 3 years down the road when we do the next experience study, and the actuaries come back and say, yeah, the data has changed, and now we're recommending a change to this particular assumption. But we're talking about the current pool of employees that are still going to get this benefit. The dynamics for them have not changed.
Yes, they have. The county has no
they
money.
Have not.
The county has no money to allow for. In order to
the
for a person to do a vacation cash out in advance, the department has to have the money in the budget available to do the vacation cash out. And if the money is not available in the budget, they can't do that. And they have, on different occasions historically, stopped that from happening by saying, we don't have the money to do the vacation cash out.
And actually, it happens on an individual basis. Say, for example, I say, I'm going to retire this next year. Based on what's currently being done at the county level, we're going to exempt you from certain things like furloughs, et cetera. So therefore, you can still benefit from the cash out and your full wage minus, you know, without having to take the furloughs. So there are exceptions being made. So, and just to go back further, we have always made decisions based on what we know to be now, and later on found that those things have changed. Just like 15 years ago, we made a decision on rates and so forth without knowing that benefits would be expanded. So it's like we're trying to, again, time retirement, time every little bit and piece, like trying to time the market, which we know is next to impossible. But I do hear what you're saying, and I think it's a valid point. But things could change from month to month. So it's like, how long do we wait?
But you also might expand upon your reference to the law, which takes effect, July of next year?
I don't know
year?
That they've passed it, actually.
No, but if they do pass it, it's
okay,
supposed to have an effective.
Don't get too far ahead.
Well, when you say things can't change, they're putting a law before that could affect things as of July of next year.
I can tell you right now that having just done recent research on AB 1987,
okay.
it has taken on a life of its own. Most of the people that supported it in the beginning have withdrawn their support. Governor Schwarzenegger has indicated he's going to veto the bill.
Okay.
So I doubt very seriously if we're going to have to worry about it.
Okay, Graham.
We would probably recommend that in the absence of information where you know that there's a long-term change to behavior and policy happening now, that you would adopt the recommendation, and then if at a later point
right.
in time, which could be prior to the valuation, if that information becomes available, you could then, make a recommendation or instruction to us to modify our assumptions. But that, this is the best information that we have today, given the data that we've collected.
The best example of that is the load factor that now has changed because of our change in our excess earnings policy. Mm-hmm. The policy has changed. The trigger, as you will, has changed. So therefore, the assumption has changed. But the benefit is still there, can still be given out. So we have to assume, and the actuary has to assume, that that's going to happen. And maybe in 3 years when we see new data, you know, we'll claw that back. But right now we have to assume it's going to take place.
So that's a great place. You could look at it in terms of the financial position. If you had several years of really good returns and you had gotten rid of the contract counts,
right,
then our analysis of what the likely impact would be would be,
right,
you know, very different. The situation would dictate.
On another point, you have the inflation assumption, and I don't have a big problem with leaving the numbers as you have them in the report. It's just that I want to be able to, without having to go through the experience report, revisit that next year. Because at this point in time, we already hear from our other advisor, our financial advisor, that they believe the inflation rate is lower than what you're reporting, by a full percentage point plus. And if that's the fact, I recognize you want to move slowly, which you said in your report, and I honor that decision. But I'm looking at us as being able to move forward on that to bring it closer into what we think might be reality based upon what we're hearing from SIS. And that number might move by, I don't know if it moved the whole 1% in 1 year, but I'm looking at maybe we could adjust that a little bit each year to try to get closer and closer to a common number. And they may be coming up, they may be coming down, I don't know, but is that adjustable?
I think you're forgetting, though, that we're looking at a long-term, not year by year. I mean, you know, our consultant's given us what he thinks the inflation's going to be for a year, not what he thinks the inflation's going to be in the next 20 years.
No, that's not true. That's a 20-year number. That number is based upon long investment periods, and it's based upon here, the actuary, too, is a long period in these numbers. These numbers have been off, and that was what Milliman said. And that's what EFI has said. And I don't disagree with any of them. It's just how much are they off?
I think you're actually both right in that it is a long-term assumption. It is longer than the horizon that the investment community is looking at. That 2.5 or 2.4% number that SIS, that is generally considered to be like a 10-year number. That number tends to trend up closer to 2.75 or 3%. At least that's what sort of Fed forecasters are looking at as you go further out. At the same time, there's nothing that prevents the board from making a decision about the assumptions, in particular the economic assumptions, at a time other than the experience study. You know, we've worked with a board that made a decision to, on an annual basis, they looked at it, and they reduced their expected rate of return and their inflation assumption by 10 basis points per year. A tenth of a percent over a 3 or 4 year period.
And if we were to move that to a larger number than it is, than you're recommending at this time, because you're saying, look, even though we have a number that we think is a little less than this number, it's not prudent to move it too quickly. I heard that in your first report, in your original report. I understand that. So as we look at that over time, we can move it. But as we move that number, if we moved it to the full extent, we would impact the employer significantly.
Well, that's partly why we set the investment return assumption. We're recommending the 8% return assumption, because the cost that comes out of using that 8% return assumption is essentially the same as if you used a 2.5% inflation assumption but expected the full real return that SIS is telling you. Mm-hmm. Use that 2.5%, I can't remember what they're saying, 7.2% nominal return, right? If you use that set of assumptions, the 2.4 and the 7.2, you get to a similar cost to what we're using with a 3.5%, 8% assumption, because we're using a slightly smaller real rate of return. So that's part of the reason for why we set the, made our recommendation for that 8% return. So hopefully, if you were moving in that direction, you actually wouldn't, you might not see a very large missing cost.
In your report, you have several places where you have indicated a price for analysis. Can you give me an idea of the difference between, like, you do different scenarios on the board, versus one that would cost, what, $12,000 for a scenario?
That was for new cure benefits.
Okay.
That was tracking a new population. And we actually had a conversation with Tom about this, that we've been asked by the county to do an analysis of the cost impact of the new tier benefits. And we would like to get some acknowledgement or understanding by the board, some recognition that the board doesn't consider this to be a conflict of interest. I don't think it was the...
They've hired their own actuaries, though. Have you worked with them?
We have worked with them in communicating information. I don't know if...
Does that put you in a conflict?
Well, regardless of what happens, if there is ultimately a change in benefits, we will need to do a cost impact of that analysis,
yeah.
Right?
That's essentially the letter that Greg gave to Tom.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, you have what the capability the other actuary doesn't. Give me a sense of why you do rather than them.
I think probably because, especially with the experience study, we're a little more up to date. Where we have the new assumptions, and you know,
okay.
Obviously they haven't been accepted yet. But if they are accepted by the board,
we're probably in
a position to do it a little faster.
Can you give me an idea? Dollars? You've got dollars on these others. What are we talking about?
The tier study is the dollars that you were. I think it was something like $8,000 to $12,000.
That was the $8,000 to $12,000. Okay.
But that would be the county paying for that analysis.
Oh. I missed that point.
I think our question was, could you do it? And you said, yeah, we can do it for you for $12,000.
Right.
What's the time factor on that?
Well, that's we were going to discuss that with them today. They're hoping to get the results within the next month. That's doable if it's a relatively simple thing where we're talking about assuming it's going to happen for all new hires rather than specific groups of people.
Gordon, if I could, we've had experience before where the employer hired their own actuary to do this kind of costing study, and then the employer acts on it, and then it comes to us as the plan's actuary.
New different.
Cost,
yeah.
And we ended up with way different. And it, part of it was that,
I was looking at the flip side. If you do it, and their actuary thought it was different.
Well, then that's a good thing, you know, in the sense it gets something worked out. But ultimately, your actuary is the one that determines the impact on the county. And so it's in the county's interest to have your actuary sort of opine on this in advance.
So you don't have a conflict working for both parties, in a sense?
I don't, not often, but, you know, sometimes there's situations where the union situation is very polarized, and I had one board member once, you know, in a similar situation where the city said, well, we want McCrory to do a study. The board member, who was president of the police union, said, fine, we'll fire him and he can do the study. You know, so those can, and so we're asking for your permission to do this, let you know clearly that we're doing it and that the county will pay for it. It can end up being an efficiency just because you don't have dueling actuaries coming in.
Is it appropriate to discuss that now, or should we table that?
I think it's appropriate to discuss now because it's not really a legal question. It's not a legal conflict.
And we've done it in the past when we did enhancement of benefits or change in benefits with our current actuary at that time. Unfortunately, that current actuary was in error. And so the experience study that came out thereafter nailed the county, but that's another story.
I have had conversations with the county's actuary, and up until this point, the last communication I had with them, they were saying that in terms of their projections of the total present value of benefits, they were within, I think, 1% of our calculations. So I don't foresee there being a large issue there.
When the county lowered the number of hours that people could use for the vacation payouts or cash outs, you calculated the impact of that, right?
We incorporated that in our recommendation for the vacation payload.
Okay, so is that what we're talking about, running the numbers for $12,000?
No, they're talking about a new tier of benefits, 3-year final average pay for new hires, I believe.
And reinstating, doing the actuarial based upon the old tier 2. Our county chief executive officer sent Tom a letter back in April when the board took initial action. For new hires.
2%.
For new hires after December 31st of 2010.
Well, my position is, I mean, it's in our best interest. I mean, the data is public domain. The work that you've done is represented here in your reports is public domain. I don't have a problem with you working, just so long as the relationship is clearly identified that you are the system actuary. They will develop their own report. Then you guys, you know, from their perspective, what the cost is, you guys will review it. And as you indicated, review it and make a determination on what the actual cost will be for the county. I think the relationship needs to clearly be defined that you are our system actuary. Beyond that, I don't have a problem with it.
And the report comes back to both board,
right.
Both us.
I'm not sure we need that report until it's implemented by the county, because I think that becomes a private matter between the county in making their decisions on what to do in their negotiations. Once they've decided what to do in their negotiations and they've negotiated, then I think it's our business. But until that time, it's not public business. It's kind of like a contractual arrangement. They're trying to decide how much should they pay on the contract or not pay on the contract.
So you're suggesting that would be given by them to the county without us unless they implement it?
Unless they implement. Upon implementation, then it would be our business. And that's why... You know, I don't know what the county wants to do. Maybe they don't care, and they don't care if it's public information or not. But in the past, that's how we've operated, so that the contract negotiations can be remaining within privacy issue between the employer and the employee.
Monica, the county's still in negotiations. I take it a final decision hasn't been made on this particular item going back to the Tier 2.
Exactly. Only on unrepresented, which includes management.
Okay, so that decision can be made by the county.
Action has already been taken on that, and that's, you'll see that in the letter that was sent to the administrator.
So that part could be reflected, even if the other is not.
Yeah, but it costs more money.
No, but I just hear you say that you had already taken that into consideration because the decision had already been made.
It was just the
change in the.
In the cash out.
In the cash out policy.
So will changing what she just said on the management and confidential employees going to that other tier impact these numbers significantly?
No, and it won't change the for the current employees, it doesn't change anything, right? And these new, it only impacts new hires, which won't even be in the, you know, this is after December 31st, 2010. So there will be no impact regardless of what's done on the July 1, 2010 actual evaluation, because none of these people have been hired yet.
We would feel more comfortable in this situation operating within a glass house so that everybody knows what we're doing. If indeed the county wants to say to somebody, what do you think about this or that, that's really a good role for their actuary to bounce ideas off of. But if it's something that's reached this kind of level of certainty, we just assume paper the walls with it so that everybody knows what we're doing. That avoids any kind of conflict.
Okay with me?
You just need a blessing, not a vote.
Is that good?
Yeah.
So maybe we would feel more confident if we did do a vote on that matter.
I don't know. Is it appropriate? It's not an action.
It's not on the agenda.
Yeah.
No.
We don't need a vote on it.
I'm sorry for that digression. It was
part and parcel, I think, of the larger discussion.
I think the minutes should reflect that Graham did inform the board and there was no objection to him performing that work.
Okay, where are we at on our actuarial decisions?
Well, let me try. I move to postpone the action until the second October meeting, financial meeting in October, end of October. Give the county an opportunity to evaluate their situation.
Did you say October? Did you say October 2nd?
The second meeting of October.
Okay.
What date is that?
October 26th.
It would probably be helpful for us to at least, when we're coding the new valuation, to at least try to move forward with some of the assumptions. I'm just saying, not saying you have to adopt the assumptions here, but things like demographic rates, the termination rates, disability rates, those things, retirement rates, at least to be able to start coding those in the system, which we've done because we did some preliminary analysis. Well, but
then why don't I just go ahead and move for approval, and if we need to bring something back, we can claw back at that point. Well, I will go ahead and move for approval, and we'll continue to talk.
Huh?
I'll move for approval of the report as it stands.
We have a motion to approve the...
wait a minute. You made modifications. Instead of the 4.2, it's 1.2.
Okay, we have a motion on the table. If we have a second, we'll discuss it some more. So we haven't agreed or disagreed.
My motion is to approve it as is recommended in the current list that came out, this most recent publication.
The August 30th.
August 30th letter. For those modifications.
So we'll hold that thought.
Don't approve it.
Okay. Unless I hear a second. We'll just pause for a second. Okay, further discussion.
Yeah, further discussion? Absolutely. Let's talk about mortality, everybody's favorite subject. We will all be there sooner or later. I go back to Milliman's actuarial audit, June 30 of 2006 for the 2003 to 06 experience study. And you... In your report, you're correct that they had recommended a change then, assuming that based upon your same assumptions that things were going to improve. But even the most recent experience study has shown that things have not improved. So I would just like some validation as to, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I understand that certain parts of the United States fall into that category, that wealth is tied to health. I know I'm lying, but I think the most recent studies in this area, and we have to focus ourselves on what our, as you said before, what our experience is going to be, has shown that we're not the norm when it comes to wealth and health. So like I said, I understand where you're trying to take us, but our own experience doesn't indicate that we're quite in that direction yet. So I would just like some dialogue as to why we're going to make this change.
If I want to speak specifically about your plan experience, in both the prior study and the current study, the current assumptions are... It's not that there's no margin for future improvement. There's negative margin, right? The actual to expected ratio was under 100% for the male members when you measure it on a benefits basis in both studies. And I believe that for the males, it was actually less than 100% on a regular number of people basis as well.
Grant, without getting into that detail, this plan, your data, your current mortality assumptions right now are not adequate. People are outliving your assumed mortality rates. They're living longer than you would expect with your current assumptions. It's about, it's a little bit bad on an account basis, but here as well, there is a benefit difference that's in the data. So we are seeing a correlation of health and wealth in your data, and the current mortality assumptions are right now insufficient for your plan. And really, the changes that we're making don't really reflect much in the way of margin, what, 5 or 10%?
5 or 6%,
very small margin. So basically, we're just moving your mortality tables up so that people are assumed to live about as long as they actually live.
So
it's your data.
I take from that what you're saying is that your study, even though the expected death was 225, if we round it up, but we actually had 233, you're saying that brief three-year period is an anomaly, and that what the prior data is showing, that we should increase our life expectancy for our retirees. Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm focusing...
That's what I'm getting out of it.
There are differences between male and female.
Well, I'm looking at the all participants. I'm just saying that I understand you're bringing, but I'm looking at the total number here.
I understand. If you look at our assumptions are different for different groups of people. Right?
I understand that.
So the males, we are recommending a more conservative table. The number of actual deaths was less than the expected deaths for the males. So that indicates that we need to be more conservative. I think we're actually a little less conservative for the females. So it's not that we're making a recommendation that you make all of the tables more conservative. We are also, you know, using a much less conservative assumption for disability, for your disability mortality rates. So it depends on what group you're talking about.
Well, I mean, the total cost is 64 basis points. I mean, it's a significant portion of the increase.
Sure.
And what I'm trying to get across is that I do not want to find ourselves in a situation where the next three-year study is done. Whoever is our actuary then comes back and says, gee, you know what? We find ourselves in a situation where, you know what? Our mortality rate was off, so now we're going to lower it. And yet for 3 years... We've had this higher load factor in there, and then 3 years down the road, we got to say, gee, you know what? Experience is showing that I don't have a crystal ball. What I'm looking at is the prior 3 years, and I understand what you're saying, but what I'm getting out of this is that those prior 3 years was an anomaly, and that what you're recommending is that we adopt these new mortality tables. Is that it in a nutshell?
Yeah, we are recommending...
Well, I know that. Otherwise, you wouldn't have put it in the report. But I'm just trying to get out of how we can have... And I'm putting some people to sleep, so I'll stop. There's... You know, we had 225 expected, but we actually lost 233. God rest their souls, but I'm at a loss to figure out, other than to say that was an anomalous event for a three-year period, and you know, you want to put us in a new table.
Okay. Again, this is accounts basis when you look at it on the amount of benefits, which is what determines your liabilities. It's a different story. I think you're actually expected significantly lower. And is lower than 100% on the plan as a whole. And again, what our new recommendations are trying to do are strengthen the mortality, make it more conservative where we see that the current tables have not kept up with what, you know, mortality has improved to. And for those assumptions like active deaths and the disability deaths, we're actually recommending less conservative tables. Now, in terms of looking at, you know, I look back at the Nolan report too, and they were recommending that they like to see a margin of at least 10% on accounts basis when they recommend new mortality tables. We're not suggesting that you go that far with these tables. But I think that even if you did see 3 years from now that your actual to expected experience was something like 105%, I'd say the vast majority of actuaries would say that these are still good tables to be using.
Those tables that we're looking at are gross tables, total deaths, but they're not broken down to specifically when someone dies, where your actuarial study in dollars amounts comes from if a person dies at 50 or 51, 52, 53, the numbers within those sub accounting arrangements are significant enough that you can have more people die within the time frame and still have a higher cost level because they're at the differential period in their life. If you have more people at 95 die than was anticipated, but fewer people die at age 50, you're going to have a higher cost because those 50-year-olds lasted longer. And so the gross number of how many died within a three-year period is not necessarily going to reflect the number. Neither is the demographics of Stanislaus County, because we're employees that work for the county are different than the general demographics.
Well, don't you also look at the, isn't it also based, because you said it was based on actually how much we were paying out, so it's also based on the amount people are getting. So
yes.
If you've got more people dying that are getting a small retirement and less people that are getting a larger retirement dying, and that's why
right.
When you show these other numbers and you're showing that we're at 94.6% when measuring the size of the benefits.
It was 94.6 based on the
number
of people,
and
but only
87
right.
When the size of the benefits.
Correct.
Yeah.
Is it significant enough to be a major change? Is it an immediate necessary change?
I would say the changes that we're recommending are not a major change compared to what we see other plans having to do. We just went through an experience study in another county where they made change their mortality tables that increased their cost by over 3% of pay, 2.5%, 3% of pay.
Mm-hmm.
So these actually, and again, the recommendations for some of these are actually less conservative mortality tables. These are it's not a significant change. We don't consider that, you know, the 60 some basis points to be a significant change with comparison to other systems where we've seen them have to put in much more conservative mortality tables. And we have plans that we've seen that are using something called the 1983 group annuity mortality table, which is significantly older than what your current tables are.
It's getting really hard now to find an actuarial experience study that isn't tidying up mortality. For a long time now, I've really been from Missouri on this idea of mortality improvement. My feeling has always been, geez, with our healthcare system sort of in slow motion collapse, how can you keep telling you that everyone's going to live longer? Nonetheless, it is now almost universal within the profession that you're seeing it. And what's more, we are seeing it in the data. We saw it in San Joaquin. We're seeing it here where your people are actually living longer than we expect. And when you add in this wealth and health impact, and thank you for that phrase, I like it, it's kind of even greater. You know, insofar as the aggregate numbers, one of the things Graham's trying to point out is we take, for example, the retirees, and we do them separately, and we take the disabled, and we do them separately. And what we found is that fewer retirees, particularly male retirees, are dying than we expect. Way more male disabled members are dying than we would expect. And so we've actually recommended us longer longevity mortality table for the male retireds who are living longer, and a shorter longevity mortality table for the disabled who aren't living as long as we were expecting. And so we're trying to make this, there's multiple new tables going on kind of simultaneously.
Okay.
In terms of where other actuaries are, we're much less conservative and much less optimistic about improving mortality than they do.
So we do a study for 3 years.
Right.
And in that study, we have more people in our system dying than we expected them to die, according to the assumptions.
As far as disabled are concerned, not so far as retired.
Well, all participants.
Yeah, but all participants we don't use for anything. It's just a sum. We
Why do you have it in the why do you have it in the chart? You have all actual deaths, 233.
It was in Excel. It cried to be sunk.
Well, I mean, no, but Darren's point is, if we're actually in the actual measurement over the 3 years, we have more people dying than we assumed would die, then you're recommending that we actually go to a different factor where we assume less people are dying in the future, correct?
No.
The,
no, that's not
we're,
correct.
We're assuming less for retired. We're assuming, are we assuming? The thing is, where are these excess deaths coming from? And the answer is, they're among your disabled members. So the mortality table we use for your disabled members will increase those rates of death to compensate. They're not coming from your retired members, where we're seeing fewer deaths than expected, especially among the males. So we're cutting back those death rates there among the retirees.
Our recommended assumptions would give you actual to expected ratios of just over 100% for all categories. And when I say just over, I mean somewhere around 105% for all categories. So the actual expected number for the disabled deaths will actually come down.
And this is worth, this is 0.6 to the 1.6, this debate.
I think it was less than, it's not 0.6 to the 1.6, the everything comes down because we're not doing the aggregation. Everything comes down because we're using a slightly higher rate of return. So we're talking about 0.64, which is something less than that. I'm guessing somewhere around 0.5% or less.
It's still, I have to agree, it still bothers me to make the change that quick. I just...
This is a change that's been recommended by three actuaries now. So Milliman, in their last study, recommended that you make this change based on the data from last time. The data from this time has confirmed that for certain groups, that experience is still there. Your actual to expected ratio for your male retirees is still less than 100%. And I think Buck even concurred when they made their letter in response to your questions. And they were concurring that they could understand why a post-retirement mortality change could be warranted.
So our choice as a board is either make the change or not make the change, really.
Accept or not accept the recommendations as posted.
Yep.
I think when you're talking about this going back to 2006, having been done in an audit where we found Buck at fault, and that's why we changed, we've had a lot of problems because of that, and Buck agrees that they may have been at fault on this. And we now have an experience study for the last 3 years, which goes more recent than the problems occurring back in 2006, which date back to 2000 probably. But whatever, I think it's not prudent for us not to act on this particular item. If we want to adjust things, we can adjust other things, but I think this particular item is...
I didn't even mention Buck. I'm talking about Milliman.
I'm talking about Milliman, Buck, and...
I'm talking about Milliman. I didn't say anything about Buck.
He just mentioned Buck.
That's fine. I'm talking about my perspective.
Excuse me.
You know, and the issue of disabled, I'm glad that was brought up, because the cost breakdown on if you're looking at a weighting factor on the cost of the system, disabled, if it's a service-connected disability retirement, that's 100% continuance to the spouse.
If they have one.
I'm just saying, if it's disabled, then, but we've had a higher number of disabled, I don't know. And we don't, I'd like to see the breakdown on you know, the service-connected versus non-service-connected. What's the true cost? I don't know.
When you print off, our final report, do you not give us a specific as to who died when in terms of 50-year-olds, 20-year-olds, those things?
No.
You don't do that? Or your estimates, your probabilities of who?
We can show you what the, provide you spreadsheets, but it's not, it's a lot of information to put in a report like this.
We used to get them in the old days, when we get off the board for a while. We used to get at the end, when we got our final report, we got a report that showed us the demographics of what the expected probabilities of lifespan were going to be for the
Oh, you mean the rates, the actual death rates?
Yeah, death rates.
We can generate those for you. I mean, they're standard because the tables that are being used are standard tables. The 1994 GAM. I can
but maybe we could maybe if we got both tables, the past table and the proposed table, that could be helpful to us making this decision. People can compare.
I would caution you that looking at those rates is not going to give you a lot of information. You're going to get something that will tell you that, you know, the current assumption is that 2.8% of people age 72 are going to die, and this table is going to say 2.49% are going to die. So if you do find that useful information, I'm happy to provide it. And our actuarial evaluation reports do contain sample values in them.
Well, I'm sure you understand his concern. What table would help us to understand that?
Well, and there have been tables done by groups like the Great Valley Center done with the assistance of Congress, actually, in the Congressional Office of Research on longevity and all the other social indicators for the San Joaquin Valley. And there is a significant difference in longevity of people who live in the San Joaquin Valley than other parts of California. I mean, that's not deniable.
Can I just
now, how that impacts this, I don't know.
I'd just like to insert that. We're talking about county employee as it compares to the mortality rates, tables, and so forth. I hate to tell you that county employees are the middle class, us and Gallup. We are the wealthy. So therefore, for talking in the community, I absolutely totally agree with you in terms of probably health and so forth are going down. But for county employees, you look at pretty, I can just say this anecdotally, people that retire are in a heck of a lot better shape.
Than they used to be.
No, absolutely. So to me, listening to the discussion going back and forth, we're splitting hairs. So if we're talking about potential retirees dying or not dying in the future, I think that's what we pay our actuaries for. I don't question the fact that we're questioning them because I think we should. And from my recollection, this is probably one of the better discussions we've had regarding actuarial studies and questions, and which is what we should be doing. But I think we're getting to the point of splitting hairs here. That having been said, any more comments? Yeah, let's keep those wealthy county employees. That's in the recording. Sorry about that. We're not wealthy.
I am.
Do you want to adopt me?
What the hell? Why not? Tax collector's going to get a little
well, anyways.
I don't have a problem with the new recommendations, the way they stated them here. So I will second Lynn's, because I really don't have a problem with them, so I think they're fine with the new 8% and the 3.5 or whatever it was. So.
Do we have any more points or items that we need to review? Besides, we've talked about mortality, we've talked about cashing out at prior to retirement, et cetera. Are there anything that might significantly affect our decisions in terms of the actuarial?
We talked about inflation rate as well.
That's right. Thank you.
Do you guys have this chart updated to the 1.6?
No.
Then do you know what those numbers would be?
No. For the valuation report?
No, this one here. Yeah. I mean, instead of 48.5 million,
no, we don't, because we haven't done the full calculation of what the new employee contribution rates would be, which will determine what the employer contribution rate is. The 1.6 is the change in the total actuarial cost.
It was 19.56, and then you were adding 4.29.
No. The total cost includes the employee portion plus the employer portion. So if the total cost goes up by 1.6, but the employee contributions go up by 40 basis points, then the employer cost only goes up by 1.2%.
Okay. Yes, but that's 1.2 instead of the 1.6. We're still looking at going up to 21% for actuarial cost percentage of payroll.
Right. These revised results were based on the increase of 4.3% in the old report was based on no change to the employee contribution rates. We said that that would be done at a later time. So that 4.3% measures the increase in the total cost as a percentage of pay. Now, to the extent that the employee contribution rates are recalculated and those might increase, that increase of 4.3% might not fall on all on the employer.
But most of it will. Greater majority.
Over half.
And now the 4.3 is 1.6.
Right.
So the total cost will go from 19.56 to 21.16% total. And most of the 1.6 will fall on the employer. Some smaller portion, but 23.2%, 23% will fall to the employees.
That's part of the
guess. So 75% of it falls on the employer.
Usually on two-thirds to three-quarters.
Yeah. Right.
Two-thirds to three-quarters is usually the employer.
Okay.
Share.
So what you're looking at is 1.6% total increase of which maybe 1.2, 1.3.
So of the 40, yeah, I mean, at 19.56, estimated employer contribution for fiscal year 2010 was $48.5 million. What's your guesstimate?
Increase that by 1.2%, something around there. Now,
1.2% or 1.2 million?
Can you calculate?
1.2%. I can't remember what payroll is.
About $600,000.
Okay.
Yeah. We have looked at the projections based on the fact that you earned more than, significantly more than 8% last year. I think it was, 15%?
15.
Yeah. So we were expecting perhaps a slight dip in cost as a percentage of pay because of the investment return. And then you also have a 5% reduction in salaries, which should affect our costs as of 7/1/2010. So, net change might be flat, between costs as a percentage of pay from last year to this year. It's tough to tell without doing it. Not run the valuation.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Last chance for questions. All those in favor of the motion, which is to accept the... go ahead.
Motion was made by Lynn Benton-Cordon, seconded by Clarence Wellman, to accept the actuarial triennial experience study as presented and with the amendments as listed in the August 30th, 2010 response from EFI Actuaries. Does that work?
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Okay. Motion carried. For the record, in case Investopia gets it, county employees are not wealthy. That was sarcasm.
For the record, the retirees are not wealthy, too. For the major.
Only
group.
One.
But he's not a retiree. Must.
Wow.
He's talking about.
Mike said he was a retiree.
Oh.
He's going to adopt me, so. He's administrator.
Okay, you have the SACRS voting proxy form, which is for each conference. They have a business meeting at the end of each conference on Friday. And normally the chair of the board is the voting member for our system, the alternate being vice chair or other board member who attends. Clearly the first, what we need to look at first is who is going to attend. So far we have Mike Fisher, Darren Barrett, Clarence Bowman, Lynn Betancourt and Lynn Stoss Burnett.
When is this?
November.
It's November
9th
through the 12th.
November 9th through the 12th.
It's in this book.
SACRS.
Okay.
Fall conference.
You going to go?
This is it.
It's after the election.
Yeah.
So currently the chair and the vice chair are not going to attend. I guess next in order would be Clarence Woolman.
Just in case.
Or
I mean, I have to stay later.
Darren Garrett, as far as order on the board.
What do you think, Clarence? Can you do it?
I can do it.
It doesn't matter.
We need what, a primary and an alternate?
Yes, a voting delegate and an alternate voting delegate.
So Clarence would be the primary and Darren would be the alternate?
If the board so approves.
Motion.
Second.
Second. Thank you. The motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. That takes us to. Oh, do you have anything else on under administration?
Nope. That
was
it.
Okay. So
we go into closed session.
Oh, thank you.
I don't have anything in closed session.
Oh, okay.
No
need.
No need.
Rescind that.
I rescind that.
Given to me.
I know it.
Closed session.
Done?
Yeah,
all in favor of going back to work right away. Okay. That takes us to members forum. Ron, you got with you?
I have
nothing for me.
Nothing at the time? Nothing.
One thing, at the end of their EFI report, it's not about the experience study. There is a discussion of funding. And I think we do need to sometime address with the county the issue that the county has a negative amortization in their present arrangement. And that's a significant problem for the county because they're paying more interest than they need to over time. Maybe they have to for a while, but there should be some plan, joint plan, and we hold the responsibility on that plan to at least encourage them to move that number to, I think they said 15 years, 16, 17 at the most, amortization period. If we roll that forward and make another 25 or another 30, then we're creating a problem. So we need to at least hold the line and leave it at 25, 24, and let it decrease over time. So I have a concern about that, but it may take care of itself over the next 7 years. I hope we can resolve that sooner. That's the only thing I have.
Okay.
Nothing.
I have
nothing.
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 And sorry, but I'm not going to be here for the next two meetings, probably. So you're in the hot seat. Stuck up the MMS. Okay, with that.